VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Gabriel Marcotter. And if we sound a little bit different this week, there's a reason for it. We taped what I thought was an excellent podcast with Ollie Kay and Julian Morins joining me this morning. But unfortunately, we were hit by the technical snafu from hell. We lost our entire recording. And so we're very grateful to Gary Jacob and Ollie and the others who came back on. We did our best to cobble together some form of podcast. And we hope that this will tide you over until next week when hopefully we won't have any of these nasty technical issues.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times. Now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the football podcast from The Times. I'm Gary Jacob, and you're probably not expecting me, you're probably expecting Gabriel Marcotter, but unfortunately we have a bit of a technical hitch, and I'm going to be like Yaya Sanogo, sat on the Arsenal bench, the type of player you don't want to see.
Di Maria with a free kick, it's now or never for Manchester United. Fellaini, great save, Van Persie, it's now! They couldn't have left it much later, and Manchester United snatch a point right at the death.
You're at Old Trafford yesterday, Ollie.
It was a very good game. One of the best games of the season so far, I would say. I can understand Mourinho and Chelsea feeling that his team were robbed and that they deserve better, because I thought they played very well. They looked like champions in waiting, really, but they were just frustrated at the end by the Van Persie goal, and it probably was a relief to the rest of the Premier League, really, because it did look like Chelsea were about to gallop away into the distance. Mm. And it at least keeps them just about within reach, because if you look at their performances, they do look like a team who can go all the way in this title.
Chelsea have conceded some late goals this season. Obviously, there's one at City, one yesterday, and there's one at Palace, which made a bit of a nervy ending. Do you sense there's any particular reason for that? I mean, people remember Mourinho's first spell, as once it was 1-0 up, you'd expect Chelsea to go and win 1-0, maybe 2-0, but he shut up shop. Do you think there's anything perhaps different about this team? Are they maybe more adventurous? Or do they give more chances? That kind of explains the late goals, or do you think it's just...
If you look at the two games in question, particularly yesterday, they did try to shut up shop at 1-0, and they sent on Mikel. They even sent on Zouma as an extra tall player in the box, but precisely in those situations, he was put on in midfield, almost right hand side of midfield position, but his role was effectively to be a third central defender at set pieces. Clearly, that didn't work, because he was the player who I think was closest to Van Persie for the goal, but their approach was very much about trying to shut up shop. And I thought they were doing it extremely well. I know Mourinho has said, with reference to the free kick and the second yellow for Ivanovic, he said, well, we could see it coming because we knew what the referee was doing. But I didn't see that United equaliser coming, because United seemed to have run out of ideas, and B, Chelsea were defending so well.
When you look at sort of last season, Mourinho got some great results. He got a victory up at Etihad, and he got a victory at Anfield. I mean, he obviously prepares for the big games so well, and he can work out the opposition. What is it, do you think, Ollie, about the opposition managers, that they can't work out Chelsea and they just can't seem to kind of get through? They can never seem to get that first goal, which would have to bring Chelsea out and maybe change the game, because once Chelsea have got the goal, they're almost impregnable.
It's a very good point. And if you look at the way Chelsea start games, they don't necessarily go flying out of the blocks. So obviously, there have been occasions when they have. I think back to the Arsenal game last season, the 6-0. But in general, they set about, you know, winning the physical battles all over the pitch, getting their players and Matic and people like that to impose themselves on, you know, in those direct one-to-one confrontations. And if they go from there, they start by imposing themselves, and then they build on it with their superiority. And it's very rare, really, that you will see Chelsea on the back foot in the first 10 minutes. In fact, it's very rare that you will see a particularly open first 10 minutes or so in a Chelsea game. It's like me that way. And I suppose one exception this season has been, I think Swansea went there and did well, but the game at the Etihad where they played Man City did very well for the first half hour or so, and then ended up sort of being worn down a little bit. Then Chelsea went ahead and the late City equaliser, which, you know, if you look at it now, those two late equalisers, which possibly didn't look like they were coming in Manchester, they are the only points that Chelsea have dropped so far this season. It's quite remarkable when you look at the frailties of others.
You can probably name the 1-11 now, which is, they've got quite a large squad. You could name who he's going to pick. And that to me is interesting, because a lot of the other teams have got squads and they're changing players, but he seems to be clear on who his best 11 are, and he's going to use them and perhaps rotate every now and again, but not in the scale that perhaps other managers are going to do.
No, he likes to rotate a little, doesn't he? He likes to keep particularly that sort of front four players. He likes to rotate things around there just to make sure that they don't run themselves into the ground, because he does like Oscar and Hazard to do perhaps more running than would normally have come naturally to them. So I'm sure Schürrle will get a lot of games. I'm sure Remy and Drogba will share the workload with Costa over the course of the season. I'm sure Fabregas will take a rest at some point, and Mikel and others will come in, but it's a stronghold squad.
You mentioned Fabregas. Obviously, people were talking about Fellaini playing him quite well. How do you see the first, now we're at sort of the 3-month level, how do you see the development with Man United and Van Gaal and how they've changed over that period?
Curious, because they seem to have changed a number of times. Really, I mean, it's not yet entirely clear what kind of direction tactically that they're going to take, and personnel wise they're going to take. Looking back, I think we can probably disregard that first few games before Falcao and Di Maria and Rojo and others came in, and when they were playing with a back three which just didn't work, they had terrible injuries at that time. I think we can disregard those in terms of the long-term trend with United, but overall, it's been fairly iffy, hasn't it? I think Ferguson said last night in his interview, he said one step forward, two steps back. Yeah. I mean, normally you would say two steps forward, one step back. But I would say, I don't know whether he got his words muddled up or whether that's really what he feels, but I would say one step forward, one step back, one step forward, one step back. And they have not yet settled into any particular way of playing that makes you think we can see the nucleus of a really good team here. And after the money that they spent, I would say they should be a few points better off than this by now. And I think that perhaps the big consolation for them in terms of the points that they've dropped, by which I mean before yesterday, is that, you know, Liverpool, Arsenal, Tottenham, Everton, these teams have been every bit as inconsistent. Champions League qualification has to be a real target for them, particularly after that late equaliser yesterday. But I do feel that they should be aspiring to better than they've produced so far.
It really has been an absorbing second half. Valencia, Creswell, it's a brilliant cross, Sacco, did it cross the line? It did! It's a magnificent 7-7 for Diafra Sacco.
Across Manchester, there's another team sort of licking their wounds. I was at Upton Park on Saturday, and I kind of don't want to tell City fans I was also at Cardiff City last year. I was also at Aston Villa where they lost on those occasions. So I'm probably a bit of a bad omen for them, and I'll let City fans know where I'm going next to follow them. But Pellegrini was...
You've presumably done all of their Champions League games over the
last 2 years. I'm there. Pellegrini, certainly after all of those defeats, he comes out and he's got a face like thunder, doesn't say anything. He's a bit like Wenger. He's kind of a terribly bad loser. I mean, the thing that was clear to me on Saturday is that the holes were just incredible, and leaving Mangala exposed, and as well as City, who's created so many chances, and they probably could have easily have won the game 4-2, 5-2. They could easily have lost 5-2. It was incredibly open. Do you feel he's got the blend right there yet? And there's a debate about whether Dzeko should be there. They seemed a bit better when Jovic came on. Is it we sort of almost a carbon copy of last season?
If you look back at last season, I think they was it something like 4 points in the first seven away games, something like that. There were a lot of people feeling that Pellegrini was continually being shocked by what he was finding from home teams when he took City away in the Premier League. It does seem a little bit like they've been doing the same again. They've been walking into traps almost. I read the interview that Allardyce did on the morning of the game, he was talking about how he will adjust for the opposition every time. And we know Allardyce will do that. He said Pellegrini is one who won't do that. He will just play his best team or his best players, and he will expect them to overwhelm the opposition. And for a spell in the middle period of last season, they were doing that absolutely brilliantly. For a spell, right at the end, towards the side of the run-in, they did it brilliantly, and obviously it was enough to win the title in a season where there wasn't really a totally convincing rival. But you look at so often at City, and there is that feeling, there is that impression that you get that Pellegrini just feels, well, we'll put Touré and one other in central midfield, they're good enough, and we'll put Nasri and Silva as the two, or Silva and Navas as the two sort of attacking players behind another front two, which was Aguero and Dzeko on Saturday. At times it does leave them very open, especially when Torre's not playing terribly well at the moment, especially when Fernandinho and Fernando haven't really had the opportunity to build up any kind of partnership. Mm-hmm. And it does seem complacent at times with the way City approach matches, and they have this plan A which works brilliantly when they're able to play games on their terms, but when they're knocked out of that, they're knocked out of that comfort zone almost. I think they struggle at times, and there are various individuals, not least Touré and company, who just aren't playing as well as they can be.
I mean, this is obviously a criticism which has been labelled at Wenger over the years. He's never a plan B. He has a certain style of playing, and he will never adapt to opposition. And Mourinho and various other managers have found him out. He still doesn't adapt. So it's kind of interesting. They both have that kind of that quality or not quality, that characteristic. I mean, one thing's going to be clear on Saturday is that Touré didn't really have any responsibility to stay in front of the back four and would happily go forward. Fernando found it quite difficult, really, to protect the back four. And of course, the fullbacks like to get forward. So it created so many opportunities. Do you think, Ollie, they will settle that down? How do you think that will shape over the season?
Well, I know that the idea behind signing Fernando this summer was that particularly in the Champions League, particularly in the bigger games, they wanted the option of being able to play Fernando and Fernandinho as a two to stop themselves being overrun in midfield, and to play Touré further forward, behind one striker, probably Aguero more often than not. Because Fernando, Fernandinho have been injured at times, that partnership just hasn't really been seen much yet, and Touré has just strolled around. Really, he's played that sort of deeper central midfield role. He hasn't looked happy. He's looked a bit of a passenger at times. And if the shape is going to be 4-4-2, then it's going to be interesting to see how they do it. Because at the moment, Touré is not playing well. Fernandinho isn't looking like the player of last season. Fernando is still trying to adjust. And if you were looking at City's midfielders this season, you'd say the best two so far have been Lampard and Milner, who were probably the two who started the season thinking that they weren't going to play at all. So it's a strange one with City at the moment.
If we sort of move to West Ham, I think people have probably... You have to go back probably 10 years to find a mood so effervescent and the giddy feeling at Upton Park at the moment. Probably Pardew's time and the year where Tevez was scoring all the goals to keep them up. There's certainly a fantastic feeling and probably vindication for the owners and sticking with Allardyce and probably also for the owners to get more involved this summer in the players they brought in. I think Wenger's always credited with having an encyclopedic knowledge of France, but there's a boy Sacco come from Metz third division just 2 years ago, and he looks lively, aggressive and dangerous. I mean, what have you made of them and Valencia and obviously the other week Liverpool were given a torrid time by them and they've done it again to City?
Well, the players they bought this summer were, you know, almost invariably strong, athletic, muscular and yet skillful players. You know, looking at it now, you would say that they've bought very well. But I suppose at the time, certainly until they bought Song, a lot of those players were what you would have called unknown quantities in the Premier League. Yet Allardyce has got this knack of integrating players into a system very quickly. And it seems like there's been a bit of a revisionism about Allardyce over the last few weeks ago as West Ham's results have improved. But I think Allardyce has always been a really good manager, a really good Premier League manager. I don't really agree with him when he says he could go and manage Real Madrid and win the European Cup with him, that kind of thing. I think his time as a potential England manager has probably come and gone, but his record is amazing. He's almost every season with relatively unfancied, unfashionable teams, he's almost always got them in the top half, and that is extremely good. And the one time that you could really criticise him, I suppose, is that first half of the season with Newcastle, where
the train is now approaching. Don't shut
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
They were going nowhere when he got sacked in the January, but they ended up going further downhill after that, didn't they? And they ended up getting relegated 18 months later. So, yeah, he will always have his critics. It's not for every club, it's not for every fan, his approach, but he is far more flexible with his approach than people have ever given him credit for. And I think we've seen over the last few weeks and few months that this is a West Ham team who will mix it up at times, but they're playing football in an appealing way, and it's winning football, and it's competitive football, competent football, and that's what fans like. West Ham fans don't want to go there and applaud sideways passes, but see their team, you know, beaten every week, as was happening under Zola and was happening under Evan Grant and Kurdishly at times. You know, they want to see proper aggressive competitive football, and that's what they're seeing at the moment.
Newcastle look full of invention here. Cabella. Perez! Oh, they've come from behind and lead 2-1. And once again, it's one of Newcastle's substitutes who play a major part in the goal. Cabella with the cross.
Joining us down the line now is Rory Smith. You were at White Hart Lane yesterday, Rory.
I was, yeah.
And last week, Pochettino was saying there was no quick fix, but he expects or hopes to get a trophy within 2 years. Is that feasible?
It depends on which sort of trophy it is, really. I would suggest the Champions League is probably out of reach, as is the Premier League title. They could get a cup, I suppose. But
Seven Sisters Shields?
Yeah, you should have a Community Shield, I guess.
No, the Seven Sisters Shield.
The Seven Sisters Shield, that would probably count. Spurs are just can't be choosers and all that. I think the thing with Spurs, though, is that they shouldn't... No one measures success in trophies anymore, do you know what I mean? It's about getting into the Champions League and then establishing yourself within the Champions League, getting there, staying there. But I think the crucial thing with Spurs, and you'll know this better than me, mate, is that they've got to kind of leave this year almost as a development year and kind of build something this season. And the worst thing that Spurs should do is what they normally do, which is struggle a bit, have a few setbacks and sack the manager and start again. I've got a lot of time for Pochettino. I know that kind of how well he's doing with Ronald Koeman's doing with Southampton makes you wonder how much of a part Pochettino played in their success last season. But I do believe he's a good manager. He's got a sort of clear, defined vision of how football should be played. And it'll take him a bit of time to introduce that. And I think Spurs have to be patient. There will be disappointing results. We know, I don't really quite get the logic of it, but we know that teams that are in the Europa League seem to struggle a little bit more after their Europa League games. There's no logic for it, but it's obviously Thursday, Sunday is no more exacting than Wednesday, Saturday. But Spurs will have setbacks this season. They will have disappointing results. They probably won't get in the top four, but they've got to understand, Daniel Levy particularly has to understand, that this is a year where you build something for next year. You're targeting getting in the Champions League in 2016, not 2015. And as long as they do that, as long as they show Pochettino a bit of uncharacteristic patience, I think he probably will get there. The question is, I mean, with Spurs, that's quite a big if, isn't it? That's you can never be certain that Levy will function that way. He hasn't done in the past. You know, he sat to the Aspo Ass after a positive first season, had a few bad months, and then he was gone. And it's happened time and time again. And I think the worry with Spurs, really, is that they're trying to turn a lot in a never-ending cycle, a repeating cycle of the same thing. Not quite failure, that's not fair, but kind of going nowhere, really, just sitting fifth or sixth and not quite cracking it. The thing they need most of all is time.
You obviously followed Pochettino when he was at Southampton. How long did it take him there to reshape things, remodel things, get his imprint? I mean, last week he was saying, well, perhaps it was 6 months, but you probably saw that development.
Well, it's kind of a phenomenon that fascinates me, to be honest. If you get a player who arrives in England and they have one really good game that's on TV against the big team. So, you know, they come in, they've been there for 2 or 3 months, they've been okay, and then they suddenly play really well against Man City or Man United on a Sky game or, in a cup game or whatever. Then suddenly everyone decides there and then that player is brilliant. And it works in the opposite. That you look at someone like Dave McKellis makes a couple of mistakes in games that are on television for Man City, and suddenly he's terrible. Everyone ignores the fact that pretty much everything else that he's done has been absolutely fine. You make one or two mistakes and you're written off. And it's the same with managers, that there's a bit of a myth about that first season, or that first 6 months, I guess, where Pochettino was at Southampton after he replaced Nigel Adkins. So they played Man City and beat them, I think, and they did very well against Liverpool. And that kind of tricked people into thinking that Pochettino came in and had this immediate impact. He didn't. He didn't actually win that many games in his first season. He got them to safety, and that obviously is a fine achievement. I'm not criticising him at all, but there was this idea that he came in, immediate impact, solved it straight away, and they were amazing. It didn't really work like that. He had those first 4 or 5 months, I guess, where he was trying to kind of implement his methods, and results were a bit varied because you are changing the way teams have played. That's true of any manager. You get very few managers who can walk into a club and change things immediately. Mourinho maybe can. If you look at Guardiola, even he hasn't done that immediately at Bayern. You know, initially, certainly in Europe at the level that they are, there was a bit of a setback last season. They got battered by Real Madrid. So it does take time. The worry with Spurs, I guess, is that there's so many players there that have been signed by so many different managers. Mm. And this affected Chelsea for a while. They've all been kind of signed by different managers with different visions of football. They've been through a few different managers, all of whom have different techniques. And I think it probably... I'm not a player, so I can't quite say for certain how they'd respond. But you wonder whether it gets quite confusing almost, that they're not quite sure what they're meant to be doing. And it's also like someone like Yunus Kabul, who at times looked like one of the best central defenders in the Premier League, but suddenly now looks like he's got a mistake in him, you know, every game. Same with Vertonghen. You wonder whether they've almost been exposed to too many different messages and they're a little bit uncertain about exactly what they're meant to do. And Pochettino will need time, I guess, to work through that period. But that's what I mean about Spurs having a bit of patience and not panicking, because if you panic, if you look for change constantly, that cycle will never break. Whereas if you just say that this season, fine, they might finish seventh, they might finish eighth if Southampton kind of keep on doing what they're doing, then as long as they don't overreact and think, right, that's it, this isn't working, let's start again, then I'm pretty confident Pochettino will get it right. And you saw at Southampton that after a while, his vision of football really did sort of take hold. And to some extent, you can look at, something if he was asked after the game yesterday, someone asked him if he regretted leaving Southampton, given how well they're doing. And he laughed it off. You can tell he was a little bit annoyed by it. He muttered something in Spanish after the game, after the press conference, to Jesus Perez, his assistant, and I don't think he was particularly impressed by the line of questioning, put it that way.
You can
say that either he shouldn't have left Southampton, or you can say that Southampton are actually benefiting from a lot of the methods he put in place, and that Koeman's continued them. You can spin it either way. But the crucial thing is that, yeah, I think for that squad that's had all these different managers, they need time. They need time to understand a new man's methods, and they need time to almost, I guess, have faith that it's worth learning his lessons, because Spurs the last 4 or 5 years, it probably isn't. You might as well just let the new manager come in, see what he does, not really take it on board, and then in a few months he'll be set.
Do you feel from seeing him that they've got the resources to play how he wants them to play, whether Kapui can play that kind of pressing game, whether some of the others that he's got in midfield can actually play that game that he wants, that he had at Southampton, or do you feel that there were players yesterday who just aren't going to be able to adapt to that style and going to be cleared out in the summer?
Yeah, that's possibly the problem, that there's a few that aren't. They're good footballers. Kapui is a good footballer. Whether he's quite right for that system, I'm not sure. There's a few others in there. Ryan Mason, actually, I thought was quite good yesterday. He looks like quite a good player.
Yeah.
Having had that weird kind of background that Andros Townsend had as well, where he was just loaned out all
Absolutely,
the time.
Absolutely, yeah.
You've got Eriksen, you've got Lamella. I think they both fit in quite nicely. I'm a bit surprised that he's sticking with Danny Rose and not gone to Ben Davis. I think Davis is a better fullback. You've got to look at whether Kabul and Vertonghen can play the high line, can play as he wants them to play. All these things take a bit of time. But the thing is that players can adapt. They can adapt to different systems and different formations, but they can't do it immediately. You have to give them a chance to kind of get used to things. And that's why you will get these slightly dodgy results early on in the process. And I guess the other thing that should be pointed out is it's a really weird lead at the moment. Mm. If you look at Liverpool, Arsenal, Man United, Spurs, Everton, they're all, even City to some extent, they're all kind of up and down. They don't seem quite sure of who they are. And Spurs are part of that, but and that's a good thing and a bad thing, because it obviously means that the others have waited for them. So even though they've had this quite poor start to the season, they're not out of the race for fourth place yet, because everybody else is stuttering as well.
So when you sat there yesterday, you must have looked to your right to see the Newcastle fans who were probably there in sort of sizeable numbers. Vitriol in the first half, perhaps with some smiles, thinking maybe Ashley will finally pull the trigger, and then probably couldn't believe it in the second half. What did you make of Newcastle and their fan reaction? And Pars must have been over the moon.
He was slightly less. I quite wanted him to come in and be all swaggery. It was a real manager's victory, that.
Absolutely.
Look at every stretch of the way, he made the decisions that had an impact. So he chose to stick with Iose Perez when Papi Cisse was ruled out, rather than change the system to accommodate a more experienced player. He sent his team out to warm up at the start of both halves, just before kickoff, because he felt that they struggled at the start of halves. They struggled to get going. He introduced the substitutes. He gave them the half-time rollicking. It was a manager's victory. You have to give credit, whatever you think of Pardew, you have to give him credit, because everything he did on Sunday worked. And he changed the game around. I suppose the one flaw is that he got his system wrong in the first place, but that's by the by. He reacted well and kind of shaped his own destiny, and that's an incredibly strong trait. I do think it must be a bit curious being a Newcastle fan at the moment, because, and you know, there'll be a lot of supporters of a lot of clubs who've been in that position where you don't like the manager. You think that the best thing for the club long term is probably getting rid of the manager, but you at the same time want your team to win. So they were absolutely delighted. Mike Ashby sort of applauded every player off who stood just above us in the director's box. It was quite precipitous. It looked like he might fall over, but he was sort of applauding and pumping his fist and beaming smile. It's a great result for Newcastle. It will give them a huge amount of confidence. It maybe doesn't quite address the underlying issues there about whether Pardew is the right man for the job and whether he can kind of get them to wherever they want to be. But then, given that Ashley's only apparent ambition is to stay in the Premier League, then there's certainly no reason to get rid of Pardew. And it may well be the case that Newcastle fans have to get used to this idea that a manager who can occasionally turn things around, and isn't Pardew's not a terrible manager. I don't think he's a brilliant manager by any stretch of the imagination, but he's not terrible. They might just have to get used to the fact that as long as he keeps them relatively close to mid-table, he's going to be there. It'll only be when there's a real threat of relegation that he comes under any threat at all.
Now on the line, we have Gabby McCotty, who wrote an article about Ancelotti in today's paper. Gabs, tell us about your article on Ancelotti and about the hard work paying off.
It was really prompted by my fascination with the situation at Real Madrid, where, you know, we talk about balance and we have certain ideas of players, and, you know, we label them, this one's a defensive midfielder, this one's a winger, this one's an attacking midfielder. But, you know, while players undeniably have certain qualities, certain characteristics, you know, ultimately they're guys out on a pitch kicking a ball. And I'm interested in sort of exploring to what degree you can get guys to do stuff that they're unused to doing. And I think Real Madrid is a perfect example. Last year they had a certain balance, thanks in large part to Xabi Alonso and Angel Di Maria, who are gone, and they were replaced by Toni Kroos and James Rodriguez, who are very, very different players. And you know, Ancelotti went into the Clásico with effectively four attacking midfielders, whatever you want to define Cristiano Ronaldo as, and a center forward in Karim Benzema. And he got these players to work and to do things that, you know, they're unsuited to doing, unsuited both mentally because they don't necessarily know how to do it, and they're not used to it, but probably also physically, you know, like the James Rodriguez and Toni Kroos, probably not used to doing the amount of chasing that they did on the day.
Obviously, you watched the El Clasico on Saturday. What were your thoughts about the game and about both teams' development and now Suarez is at Barca and how that will go forward?
Well, I think Luis Enrique, the Barcelona coach, made some very big calls in terms of lineup. That, you know, calls that Ancelotti didn't have to make because really his 11 was pretty much set for him without Gareth Bale. Isco was always the most realistic guy to come in. But Luis Enrique made, I think, three big decisions. He played Jeremy Mathieu at left back. Mathieu, of course, is a left back by trade, but he's been playing center half, and he's been playing center half very well for sort of the last 2 years almost. Instead, he moved him to left back, presumably to neutralize or to help neutralize Cristiano Ronaldo. That didn't work. In midfield, he went for the experience of Xavi in place of Ivan Rakitic, who probably has been arguably Barcelona's best player this year. And, of course, up front, he decided to play Luis Suarez, who hadn't played a competitive match in 4 months owing to his ban at the World Cup. And I think you probably could have gotten away with one of those decisions, maybe two, but all three, that was just too much, and they sort of had a cascading effect. The front three of Barcelona didn't track, and crucially, they didn't press either. I think a lot of that has to do with simply not being used to playing with each other, you know, which is something that will come in time. Xavi got overrun in midfield, and again, that was made worse by sort of the dysfunctionality of the front three. He was put under far more pressure, and, you know, at his age, he wasn't up for it. And Mathieu simply had a very poor game at left back, with the exception of one driving shot, which Casillas saved well. He didn't, you know, he really contributed very little at both ends of the pitch. So I think in some ways, you know, Luis Enrique got those things wrong. Although, all that said, on the day, given how well Real Madrid played, I'm not sure that even with different decisions, there would have been a different outcome.
Thank you so much for your time, Gabs. And I know you'll be back here in the studio next week, and I'll be elevated back to my flat to work. As I described at the start of the show, I'm like Yaya Sanogo and you're Thierry Henry, and you'll be back in the hot seat next week.
I certainly hope so.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Hi, I'm Tim Montgomery, the presenter of another Times podcast from the opinion pages called Did You Read? It's the perfect weekly snapshot of some of the best writing in the newspaper. Find out more by heading to thetimes.co.uk/commentcentral and search Did You Read to subscribe on iTunes.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts,
Calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.